Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Caroline White, Deputy Editor. Caroline, kick us off by telling us a bit more about this week's interviewee.
Yeah, so this week's interviewee is Mark Boddington, who is the founder of Silver Lining Furniture. He's from the Boddington beer family, as the name suggests, but rather than brewing, he chose to go into luxury furniture design, and he set up the UK-based studio Silver Lining, which does loads of work for superyachts. I actually visited their studio about 10 years ago, and it was really a fantasy land, working with incredibly rare materials in really imaginative ways, experimenting, creating the most exquisite, unusual finishes, really something to see. They really are something rather special, and I thought that Mark would be a great person to tell us a little bit about how the superyacht industry is changing from what he's seen working within it in the last 10 or so years.
I drank a lot of Boddington beer when I was younger. They used to have those great ads on TV, Boddington, I always remember.
Yeah, and they did. Famous. With the ice cream cone.
Yeah, that's right. They were brilliant ads.
Yeah.
So it worked on me, obviously, because I drank a lot of Boddington. But yeah, Silver Lining. I've been on some boats sometimes, and you know, you ask who made the table or the sideboard or whatever, and it's Silver Lining. It's just exquisite stuff that they do up there. So yeah, it'd be great to hear more from Mark. So talking about exquisite boats, I'm thrilled to say we finally have run our Eclipse feature online. So this story originally ran way back in April 2016 in the issue, the April 2016 issue of the magazine. As Caroline knows full well, getting permissions for these boats is incredibly difficult, and it takes a long time, and there are seemingly endless hoops and hurdles. But finally, I remember when we got the call saying we could run the feature back in 2016. We were halfway through producing the April issue. We're going to tore the whole thing up and start it again. Rebuilt the whole issue basically around Eclipse. And it was a massive exclusive. No one had ever got this kind of information access or the images before, but we did. But obviously running a story like that in print is one thing, you know, with a fairly relatively modest distribution, but albeit to a very qualified audience, but then sticking it on the website, owners sometimes get a bit funny about that because they don't know, you know, it can be obviously viewed by anyone at any time, etc., and photos can be nicked and run elsewhere. But I'm thrilled to say we finally got the sign off after 5 years, mind you, to run the story online. So please do go check it out. So it's one of my favorites, and I'm not just saying that because I wrote it. It was just a really good feature.
If you do say so yourself.
So
that's boatinternational.com if people want to read that.
Yeah, head there now. We're recording this on Thursday the 20th, so a few days out of the Monaco Grand Prix, and boats are streaming into town ahead of the event. I'll be catching up with Boat International columnist Eddie Jordan on Monday to hear all about it. So he's very excited, actually, because his boat Blush, his big Perini, is in the harbour for the weekend. So other boats in town include 74.5-metre Zeus, very famous boat, 101-metre Symphony. Actually, Symphony's another boat that we ran in the magazine but never got permission to run it online. I'm trying to jump through various legal hoops to achieve that at the moment. And also 96.55-metre Faith is in town as well. It's a smorgasbord. There's almost 100 superyachts in and around Monaco, and more on the way. The Grand Prix, of course, was cancelled last year due to COVID, so there's a massive appetite for this year's event. So if you're going, I hope you have a great time, but I don't want to hear anything about it because the envy could just push me over the edge.
Absolutely. And I guess this year, more than any other, the place to watch the race is from a yacht, which is the perfect solution for social distancing.
Yeah, quite right. Quite right. It's the dream, isn't it? It's everywhere. If you haven't got watching the Monaco Grand Prix from the back of a superyacht on your bucket list, what are you doing, quite honestly? On a slightly more serious note, and a slight change in tack for Boat International's editorial coverage. As I've repeated many times on the podcast, we now have a business editor who is kind of pumping out this great insight and analysis about the superyacht industry. And he reported recently about marine manufacturers. This is actually something I wasn't terribly aware of, but it's been quite enlightening hearing about it. So marine manufacturers are breathing a sigh of relief this week as the EU binned plans to increase tit-for-tat tariffs on US boat and engine imports to a whopping 50%. So they were at 25%. They were threatening to increase them to 50% from the 1st of June. And the tariff spat began during President Trump's term when his protectionist impulses took over and he slapped a 25% import tariff on various goods made in the EU. The EU retaliated with a 25% tariff on US-made yachts and engines, which saw imports of those to the EU plummet. Sense seems to have prevailed, however, and the proposed increase of this EU tariff to 50% has been cancelled, and industry bodies on both sides of the Atlantic are lobbying for governments to cancel the tariffs altogether, which seems eminently sensible to me. Anyway, we're keeping a very close eye on the story as our business coverage ramps up ahead of the launch of our new boat business channel in June, which I'm very, very excited about. We're going to be bringing you breaking stories from the B2B world of superyachts, great analysis, insight. It's going to be fantastic. So keep an eye out for that. Right, that's quite enough of me. Caroline, what's our headline story this week?
Well, FedShip has launched its 95-metre hybrid superyacht Bliss. Exterior design is by Studio De Voogt, while Remy Tessier penned the interior. She's described as a world traveller, so she's certified to cruise the polar regions and will have a range of 6,000 nautical miles at 12 knots. We haven't yet glimpsed inside, but we know she's got a large swimming pool and a helideck, which converts into a sports and games deck. As with most FedShips, we don't know a huge amount yet, but we will keep you posted as we learn more.
Maybe it's just me, but it seems to me FedShip are knocking out a 90-metre yacht every other week at the moment. It's incredible.
I know. It's almost difficult for us in our news coverage in the magazine not to just make it FedShip International and have a FedShip on the first page of news every month. They are doing pretty well, I think.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, really. I should say, I'm going to get a letter about saying knocking out, aren't I? FedShip don't knock out yachts.
Carefully crafting a 90-metre every month.
Yeah, spare your letters. Meanwhile, Vrypak and RMK Marine have revealed a very cool 36.5-metre pocket explorer. The first RMK 120 will be named Seven Seas and combines a trawler-style exterior with a family-focused interior. The RMK 120 is now envisioned as an explorer line, but it was first created for owners who wanted to upgrade their current yacht. They wanted everything you typically have in a 50-metre, 500-gross-ton boat, including a proper tender capacity, which is obviously that's one of the most important factors in an explorer design, but on a vessel small enough to tuck into little bays. The Dutch studio Vrypak have likened the resulting boat to a Jaguar SUV.
How exciting. I love the way Vrypak describes things. They really do give a good quote, that studio.
Yeah, they do.
Well, sticking to the Explorer theme, Ocean Independence is offering a 57-metre cable-laying vessel for sale that's ready for conversion to an expedition yacht. Now named Project Phoenix, the vessel spent 30 years in commercial operation and has now been stripped back to bare steel. It's listed for sale as a conversion opportunity, with plans already drawn up to transform it into a superyacht. The project will be undertaken by the Turkish yard, ICT, and includes a team of superyacht experts, including Frank Lautmann's Omega Architects, which has redesigned the boat inside and out, and Naval Architecture, which has been penned by Van Oosenen Naval Architects.
And finally this week, the Italian Sea Group has secured financial backing from none other than Giorgio Armani and the Belgian pharmaceutical entrepreneur Marc Kuka, or Cook. Kuka or Cook, I don't know. Please write in, Belgian listeners, in preparation to list its shares on the Italian Stock Exchange. It is unknown how big the investments will be, but Giorgio Armani and Kuka will eventually hold a combined stake of 15% in the Italian Sea Group. Shares of around 50 million euros will be newly issued in the IPO, while existing shares are to be sold by GC Holding, which is controlled by Italian Sea Group chief executive Giovanni Constantino. So there's a bit of a flurry of IPO activity in Italy at the moment. San Lorenzo, obviously, now the Italian Sea Group. Interesting times.
Absolutely.
And as we all know, Italy, as we learnt last week, actually, Italy is the leading manufacturer of superyachts globally, and a big chunk of their output are semi-custom vessels, and those kinds of boats are the subject of this week's data story. Caroline, over to you.
Thanks. So, as you say, we're going to look at the rise of semi-custom yachts this week, and by that I mean yachts that are part of a series or based on a platform.
So an example might be Sunseeker's Predator series, or Heesen's 50-meter series, or even Bonetti's new 40-meter Oasis line, which I think they've already sold 8 of or something, which is really quite incredible.
Amazing, yeah. So it's a subject that has featured in other data segments we've discussed, but we thought we'd take a look at it head on this month, how it's changing and what it says about the market. So if we look at all 11,415 yachts delivered and afloat up to the end of 2020, 39.3% are full custom yachts and 60.7% are semi-custom yachts. If we look at the top builder nations, Taiwan comes out on top in terms of semi-custom by proportion. So just under 93% of the yachts it puts out are semi-custom. That's followed by Italy, as Stuart mentioned, with 85.5% of its output being semi-custom. And the UK, where just over 70% of yachts are semi-custom. If we take a long look back at the very early 20th century, the percentage of semi-custom yachts delivered each year lay between 0 and about 3%. That jumps up to about 26% in the 1940s, and we think that's related to the war and the number of ex-military boats that were converted into yachts afterwards. Semi-custom series of 24-metre plus yachts mainly started in the 70s, so you can see that at this point the popularity of semi-custom yachts really starts to climb steadily. By the 80s, of all yachts delivered, nearly 29% were semi-custom. By the 90s, it was more than half. And by the 2000s, it was nearly 77%. Then between 2010 and 2020, nearly 78% of yachts delivered were semi-custom.
So that's really just the story, isn't it, of semi-custom production completely taking over super yachting at the beginning of the last century. As you'd expect, there's very few boats. And of course, they're all custom boats. You know, the industrialization of super yachting really hadn't happened, and then from the 70s the semi-custom just absolutely took off.
Exactly. I mean, I wonder now if we may have hit the ceiling in terms of the proportion of yachts that can be built semi-custom. So you're always going to have a percentage of yachts that are too enormous or too individual to be semi-custom models. So if we look at the latest two figures I mentioned there, by the 2000s, it was nearly 77%. And then between 2010 and 2020, nearly 78% of yachts delivered were semi-custom. So with those two figures haven't changed enormously. And I wonder, as I say, if that's as high as we can go with semi-custom production.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll certainly keep an eye on it. But, you know, it speaks to an owner class who, more and more owners coming into the market who don't want to wait all those years for a fully custom project. They want a boat now, and obviously semi-custom answers those needs.
Exactly, and more customization can be done in semi-custom, so the gap between a custom boat and a semi-custom boat is shrinking and becoming more and more attractive to have a semi-custom boat.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, I mentioned the 50-meter Heesen series earlier. You put two of them against each other, and whilst they look much the same from the outside, they can be utterly different on the inside. So, yeah, significant customization obviously is available in these platforms. Alrighty, thanks for that, Caroline. Fascinating insight into the growing popularity of semi-custom production. So without further ado, let's move on with this week's interview, which sees Caroline talking to Mark Boddington of Silver Lining Furniture.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. I visited you a long time ago, maybe almost a decade ago, and my memory from that experience visiting you in Cheshire. Are you in Cheshire, Silver Lining?
Well, we've actually moved to Wales. We're in North Wales now, but yeah, very close to Cheshire.
Okay, well, my memory from visiting your amazing studios was that you were doing all sorts of crazy things. So you were creating furniture from 3,000-year-old bog oak, and you were sending divers down to get pieces of leather from a shipwreck. Am I remembering that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got a good memory.
So what exactly was the idea with the leather that you were getting from the bottom of the sea?
Well, we're always trying to, you know, find fascinating materials, particularly ones with history. And this is leather that's comes from a boat called the Meta Caterina that sank off Plymouth Sound in 1786. And the leather, having been kept as rolls in the sea, in the seabed, it's been perfectly preserved. And it has this amazing, you can still see the texture of how it was actually tanned and the finish put on it from 1786. So materials were the story, really. And we're always looking for new things that have got connections, something interesting for a commission that, a client can talk about.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible, it's almost like a sort of fantasy land, some of the work that you do, and we'll get into that a bit later. But to start off with, could you tell us a little bit about how you personally got into the world of luxury furniture in the first place? So I understand that you're from the Manchester Boddington beer family, Mark Boddington. So could you tell us a little bit about that? It doesn't seem like an obvious path.
Well, I think the first honest view is I didn't do well enough in my exams, so that was a good start. But I think I have a built-in affinity with the arts. I mean, my great-grandfather on my mother's side, he was quite a successful banker, and he was a big collector of Pre-Raphaelite art, including Rossetti's, which he actually commissioned 17 paintings. And there's actually, wow. I recently got a book about it and was reading about it and came across quite a funny story. He commissioned a painting called Venus Turner of the Hearts, and he actually asked Rossetti to mask the nudity because he thought the woman in the painting was too voluptuous and his words were, for a respectable old timer like me. So wow. I think he had a bit of sense of humour with his commissioning. And then on my father's side, he was obviously in the business, as you said earlier, and he actually commissioned a lot of furniture from a thing called the Century Guild, which actually was a collection of artists, architects and craftsmen who got together in 1882 for about 20 years because they were actually worried about post the Industrial Revolution that creativity and craftsmanship was going to disappear. So it's quite interesting, how we're doing the same thing, 160 years later with our academy, because obviously technology, in theory, these skills could disappear, but I don't think they will actually.
Absolutely. Well, that's really interesting. We'll talk about the Academy a little bit later. So could you tell us how Silver Lining started off and then how it got into yachts as a business?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing, I'd always been fascinated about furniture from a very small boy. My mother used to take me to every antique fair that was in Britain in the school holidays. And I remember going to places like Chatsworth House and seeing amazing craftsmen and artists from the past, particularly Grin and Gibbons, who does these 3D carvings. This is in the 18th century, and these carvings are so deep you can put your arm in them. And also, obviously, everyone talks about Chippendale. I went to every house that he had his furniture in, and it gave me tremendous inspiration. But I also think, if you know the history of a topic, it can make you a very good designer, in today's. So I failed my exams or A levels. I was going to go and do land management, which my father wanted me to do. So that was the end of that. And then I went and trained with a John Makepeace, who many people know, famous furniture designer. And like an idiot, I decided to set up age 21 and set up a workshop. But I think the fortunate thing was our first workshop was on the estate of the late Duke of Westminster. And through them, we started working for them and friends of theirs. People like the Gettys, people like that. And it grew from there. And then having worked on Eaton Hall, which was the family home of the Westminsters, one of the designers that was working with them then moved to Andrew Winch. And that's how we got our first boat, which was actually in 1995, which is quite an interesting first boat because it was the boat that was owned by the Prince Geoffrey of Bolkai. And there's a whole story connected with that boat and what happened to it, which was interesting, but we won't go into that.
That's very, very discreet of you. And then how do you find, so I now, could you tell us what the kind of balance is now between kind of residential projects for Silver Lining and yacht projects, roughly?
I think now, I mean, in 2008, we were actually only working on boats when the downturn came, and actually we were only working for Russian nationals. And I think we learned that lesson that, to have a good business model, you need to be in residential and yachts. And in fact, we're actually now doing jet aviation as well. And also work in many countries in the world. We've actually now got projects in 17 countries throughout the world. We're doing a lot of new work in Asia. So we try and keep it 50-50. But to give you an idea, I actually added up before we were going to chat. We've got about 890 metres of boats under build at the moment, which is about 11 projects between now and 2024. So it's quite nice to have these yacht projects because they can be quite large, and then you can fit in other residential projects between them. But we try and keep a balance.
And how do you find working with yacht owners specifically? Are they different from your residential clients? Do they bring any different approaches or requirements or sensibilities to the projects?
It's an interesting question because we actually did a survey of, particularly with this question, over the last sort of 3 years. And I mean, one of the interesting things is on boat projects, we tend to find we're more often dealing with a male person, and with the house we might be dealing with a female person, and of course they have different dynamics. And I think one of the reasons for that is boats obviously have a build slot and they have to be finished and you have to hit deadlines and things, and maybe men are more driven to hit deadlines, whereas with house projects they seem to be happy for things to overrun, maybe because they haven't got penalty clauses or whatever for the next build. But it's very interesting dealing, because you get different perspectives. I would say male clients tend to be a lot more practical. They want to know about maintenance. They want to know how durable it is. Whereas maybe, from a female perspective, it's more about the aesthetics. I would say the difference between when I started 30 years ago and now is we're seeing a lot of younger owners. I mean, owners used to be probably 65 to 75. 20 years ago, now they can be in their mid-30s or even younger. And I think this is because of, obviously technology and, a lot of younger people can, amass, wealth quite quickly, particularly in the internet businesses, when a business can go from, zero to hero in 3 years. It's not like building a manufacturing business or even furniture making, which takes 30 years to get a reputation. So we're seeing younger owners, and the great thing with younger owners, they're very open to new technology, new ideas. I mean, to me, I see them as sponsors of research and development, really, for the wider industry. It's almost like Formula One, but it's on water.
How interesting. Well, on that note, could you tell us about how you've kind of responded to that change? Some of the sort of the new projects and new finishes that you've been able to work on based on that kind of new owner who's supporting that sort of development?
Yeah, I think it's two things. First of all, it's how they live and how they want, the legacy they want to leave, in doing their project. For example, obviously younger owners, often they've got families. So boats tend to be a lot more informal now, indoor, outdoor living. People are wearing shorts rather than suits. These aren't boardrooms that people are living on. So, and they want all the toys that can go with it. They want to do every sort of water sport. They want to perhaps look at the ocean from a scientific point of view. So submarines, we're seeing research vessels that are also super yachts now, which is amazing. So it's how they live. It's what they do. Everyone wants to spend more time with their family. And I think even post-COVID, when we hope that's over, everyone will do that in their life. Life is precious and they'll want to spend time with family and friends. I think also they want to have boats that are more durable, more sustainable, kinder to the earth. But obviously, there's a dichotomy there. You might say, well, how can a super yacht be sustainable? But actually, these people, through building their super yachts, are actually driving sustainable industries. I mean, only last week I was reading about Lursen, who are doing a hydrogen power test over the next year to hopefully use hydrogen power, in yachts, which I'm sure my children's generation, we're going to see hydrogen powered cars, which would be fantastic because obviously there's no pollution with them. So they're drivers of this technology. What do they want from their life? They want multifunctional spaces. So for example, we're doing a dining table that's also three card tables. We're doing a games table that becomes a dining table. We're doing we've just finished a dining table, which also then a drinks cabinet pops out the middle. So after dinner, they can use it for drinks. And it's also got a Lazy Susan built into it, so they can have Chinese banquets. All the usual things, tables that rise, that fall, Even, you know, you're seeing swimming pools that become dance floors. So they want multifunctional spaces because, you know, whether they're chartering for their family, they want to live in different ways depending on their mood, etc. And then in terms of materials and things, as I talked about sustainability, maintenance, I think, you know, we're seeing definitely a trend to go away from anything that's sort of shiny, high gloss, because it's high maintenance, you know, fingerprints. You know, high gloss metals need a lot of maintenance. So they can have less crew. So we're seeing almost a connection with the sea. So a lot of texture, materials that don't fingerprint, materials that are easy to clean, materials that are very durable, lighter materials. But really a drive for materials that are sustainable as well. We're using a lot of things like, first of all, we're using waste materials to create what we call neo-luxury, for an example. We have a thing called Innovation Friday, which is on Fridays. Anyone in the company for half a day can do what they like. They can experiment. They can learn some new software. Even during COVID, they can go for a walk or whatever. And we found this really successful. And one of the gentlemen that works in our laser department decided to pick up the dust or the offcuts, tiny little fragments from the laser, and drop it into some bio resin to see what effect it would create. Anyway, we created this pattern and we developed, and we're actually doing two artworks for a yacht, which we call Big Bang, because they look like an explosion of, you know, of the earth. And it's amazing. And we're doing another material where we're using all the offcuts from leather, which we glue together and create like a striated pattern that looks almost like layers of rock.
So it sounds like you're sort of approaching nature as a company, both as inspiration and also as a kind of practical resource. Can you tell us a bit more about that, how you work with nature, how you learn from nature?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's Leonardo da Vinci said that nature's got all the answers. And I think when you study nature very closely, it's probably true. I mean, we use nature as an amazing, you know, inspiration for creative ideas. For example, we've just done a table. It's in brass and bog oak, and its design is derived from the contours that you see from space of paddy fields in China. You know, those beautiful winding shapes and the light and shade on it. We've also just done another table which is inspired by lava flow from Hawaiian earthquake. So we're always using nature. We also use, you know, for example, we've just done the cabinet called the Fibonacci cabinet, and the Fibonacci sequence is named after an Italian mathematician who worked out that the two preceding numbers made the next number in the sequence. And actually, you see that in nature, in flowers. And if you actually look at a sunflower, you'll find that that sequence is in the sunflower. So there's lots of ways. It could be a pattern, it could be a color, it could be light and shade. But we also use nature to solve technological or, you know, create new innovative finishes. For example, everyone talks about nanotechnology, you know, and ceramics are coming out to make, you know, fabrics waterproof, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, one of the things we're doing right now is we wanted to create a new material using colored straw. So this is natural waste material, and laminate it in bioresin to create these sheets, almost like you get in a beehive, you know, honeycomb effect. But we couldn't get the straw to bond because on the outside of the straw, it has this cuticle wax, which stops any other glue adhering to it. So we actually set up a study with Bangor University to find out how this straw or cuticle wax could be removed. So actually what we did is we studied insects that actually glue onto straw and breed, and we found the answer how to remove this cuticle wax, because in these insects there's a chemical which will remove this wax, which then allows us to glue the material together. So we've created this honeycomb sheet that's super strong from straw. It's see-through, and it, you can use colored straw, so you can get these sort of wonderful patterns in it, but it's phenomenally strong. And all it is nature. We're using bioresin from soybean, so that's totally natural. And we're using straw, you know, which is used from the food industry.
How fascinating. That's absolutely incredible. So all of this innovation, presumably takes a lot of people with a lot of skill. Could you tell us something about, you mentioned there, your kind of program with younger people and training them to preserve skills and perhaps create new skills. Can you tell us something about that and what you think Silver Linings' lasting contribution to the world of furniture might be through that?
Well, I think you've got to, you know, anything's got to be relevant to the period that we're in. I mean, you know, so we're in the 21st century. So we're trying to create or define what 21st century craftsmanship is. You know, we have a lot of technology to help us. We have material advancements and we have things like 3D printing. We have digitalization that can be done very quickly on computers. So we're using the latest technology. And actually, you know, it may sound horrific to some people, but we actually use 3D printing to create parts on our furniture, which are quicker than carving them. And then we cover them in leather and things. So we're using the latest technology. So I think you've got to keep it relevant. And also to keep people in the industry, it's got to be very stimulating. So we're always learning and doing new things. And I think that's what keeps people at Silver Lining. But then you've got to bring the next generation through. And there was a study done recently with all this, you know, what's happening with artificial intelligence. The creative industries are actually going to grow, which is fantastic because, you know, they're things that can't be done by computers or machines. You know, hand craftsmanship can only be done with, you know, it's coordination between someone's eyes and their hands. So it's very important to pass those skills on. And that has to be done in person and mentoring them through apprenticeships. I mean, how we do it, we have an apprenticeship. And then once the person's done the apprenticeship, they then actually work with a team of experienced furniture makers and the team leader to gain experience. And then they could go on to become a team leader or a draftsman and a project manager. So for us, there's a whole career path within Silver Lining. But I think it's really important to keep, you know, make craftsmanship relevant to today and today's materials and technology.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate your time today. So I think let's leave it there.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.